Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill.
And today on the show, all about bees for
beeswax,
the most part.
Bee business, be good.
Be good. Yeah. Plan B.
Right.
Plan B is a great little book called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. It's by Susan Brackney, who's a nature writer and beekeeper up in Bloomington, Indiana. You know, great tale to be told. Yep. Historically, what's going on now. Also some instruction. Just a really delightful little book. So we're going to talk to her in the second part of the show and, you know, just really try to understand and appreciate all bees, not just the honeybees. Charlie Nardozzi is going to join us as well to give us a little primer on what kind of plants we should include in our garden to really sustain them.
Yeah, it's no easy task to take a complex subject like the bee culture and make it readable and fun and mm-hmm. interesting. She even has a quiz in the back of the book that was kind of fun to take on the personality perhaps required and the character traits required to become a beekeeper, analogous to human behavior. And it's really an interesting book, and mm-hmm. she did a great job with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's fun to talk to. Very interesting.
All right. So we'll have that coming up on the show today. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Blueberries. We planted them 3 years ago.
Good.
Miss Wishy, you've been hauling in blueberries here by the pickup load for years.
Uh-huh.
And we finally got our own first time. It's just like a little... half a pot, the first picking, I have to admit, but we're there. Just it took, as advertised, it took two mm-hmm. or 3 years to get what we wanted.
Because how big are the plants now?
Oh, they're probably 3 to 4 feet. One of them is pushing 5 feet.
That's really big.
Yeah, we got
awesome.
Too many of them. Well, they're not really thick.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of lean and mm-hmm. mean looking. We got too many too close together. We'll have to do something about that.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is we got blueberries
yeah.
to go with our strawberries and raspberries.
Fun. Yeah.
And the other thing is, have you ever heard of the loropetalum? Plant called loropetalum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm trying an experiment because it's not supposed to be hardy here, but some people I know are planting it in Louisville and doing very well. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. little shrub. It's real heavily blooming in the spring, kind of a pink flower and great fall color on the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm conducting an experiment. I'll report back next spring if it lives or dies. I'm planting out some loropetalum in my yard.
So is it a hardiness issues in the
yeah.
wintertime?
Yeah, it's hardiness cold. To zone 7, but then you... as they always say, plants can't read.
Okay.
And it says 0 to -10, which indicates to me it would do fine here.
On most.
Yeah, it's hard to find in mm-hmm. the nurseries now because of that reputation for dying. But
okay.
once it catches on, if it does, it's going to be a real yeah. a real hit around here.
In that nice little, you know, microclimate,
yeah.
sort of warm corner of the winter
yeah.
garden, right?
The loropetalum.
Loropetalum.
What's up in Shelbyville, or I'm sorry, Simpsonville?
I have been, speaking of blueberries, I've been picking blueberries like crazy.
Ah.
Some of these shrubs, you know, are probably 25 years old,
oh, yeah,
and I've maintained them well. But it's just a bumper crop. And the cool thing is that I'm able to sell them to a farm market because we're listed as Kentucky Proud.
There you go.
So I can sell them and without being, you know, a farm market person and get them to the farm market. So that's a little bit more gratifying as well.
So is that was your Cadillac I saw parked in front of the building?
Hardly.
Blue Cadillac?
No.
It?
Speaking of which, I'm... My Subaru station wagon, what good is the station wagon if you can't get the back open? I can't get the back open. So I'm hauling my blueberries around in the back seat because my lock is somehow jammed and I can't get the back of my car open.
Wishy Proud Incorporated.
But anyway, the blueberries are bringing me some delight as well. Another thing, when I was picking blueberries the other morning, what I hear in various directions, Bob, is...
Bob White
quail.
Yep.
So I'm hearing them, right?
Mm-hmm.
This makes me happy because this is one of the purposes of the prairie, to create a better habitat. Then I hear one that's a lot closer, so I want to investigate.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, I never caught sight of them on that particular morning, but I'm hearing them every morning, so I'm delighted. The other day, I was getting my mower ready, getting everything mowed because I needed to ship it off to get serviced. And... a bobwhite quail was running full tilt boogie away from me between the blackberries and the asparagus, like on a road, basically.
It had a mission, I suspect.
It was running so fast, and it was the first time in my entire life that I've seen a bobwhite quail in real life,
huh.
right off the prairie.
Wow.
So I have bobwhite quail in the prairie back
Congratulations.
Again because they've been gone.
Yep.
You would never hear them.
You've done it.
And I've seen it, and that was what was so thrilling, not just hearing it.
I love that bobwhite whistle.
Yeah.
I grew up a kid in Northern Illinois.
And you heard it
all the time.
And never anymore.
Red-winged blackbirds.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm very proud to say that we have bobwhite quail in the prairie.
Good for you.
All right.
How about some calendar events for the garden? I've got one here myself. It's the Garden Club of Elizabethtown is having its garden tour and tea on Sunday, June 27th from 1 to 5 p.m., there's six private gardens in the Cunningham Garden at the historic Brown Pusey House, where I just gave a talk a couple weeks ago. It's a great garden in a great town. And
it is. It's a good group of people, too.
It is, too,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Garden Club Elizabethtown, go see them.
June 27th on
right.
Sunday. And yeah. on Saturday, June 26th, you can also check out some beautiful gardens in Audubon Park. It's their garden tour, basically just going to Audubon Park. And they've got like a little like clubhouse almost.
Oh yeah, right. I know.
For lack of a better word, their little town meeting place, and you can go in there and get your map and the directions to all the gardens. But yeah, June 26th, Saturday from 10 to 4, Audubon Park. You can go to our website at wfpl.org for more details.
And there'll be bees in both places, I suspect.
There will be loads of bees in both places.
And we've got a couple people here to help us out. The first one will be a man named Charlie Nardozzi. He was senior spokesman for the National Garden Association, former editor of the National Gardening Magazine, a commentator on Vermont Public Radio, and has contributed to many national gardening forums and television shows. He's with us today to talk about the flowers that the bees most love and why. Charlie, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, let's have a little, I always like the background first, but I'm primarily interested in maybe your first encounter with bees. Was it friendly or non-friendly, and do you remember?
Well, it probably wasn't, what I remember is not the encounter with the bees, but it was a wasp, probably. And I remember as a small boy growing up in the shadow of my Italian grandfather's farm, he had apple trees. And we would go with his pickup truck and these big barrels to collect these apples from the apple trees that he would make into cider and all kinds of things. And as you know, apples rot, and when they rot, they attract bees, and in this case, were wasps. So I remember getting stung on the face and crying all the way back to the farmhouse. That was my first memory of those types of insects, which is too bad because most bees, like honeybees or solitary wasps, are not going to attack you unless they're very distressed.
Mm-hmm.
And people have an unusual fear of them, which is not really warranted, that they are in danger if these bees are flying around.
You know, I don't think I've ever been stung by a little honeybee. I've been stung by wasps like you, and that really hurts. But I don't think I have been by a little bee. I guess that's why I'm not afraid of them.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
Well, I know if you're working hives and things, or if they're swarming, that they can be a little more aggressive. And, of course, with the African bees and the whole concern with that happening, those bees have a little more aggressive behaviors.
Yeah.
Yeah. You ever get any sense that bees are after something besides pollen or doing their thing with making honey, some larger scale picture?
They have a bigger purpose in life?
Yeah. Unlike the rest of us.
Bob's still seeking the answer to this question.
You think bees are going to give you the answer, Bob?
What's
yes,
it all
everybody.
Mean, Charlie? I need to know this. What's it all mean?
Well, they are very organized, and they have an amazing social system and amazing way to communicate with each other as far as where the pollen is, where the flowers are, and how to come back, and they do a certain dance when they get back to the hives, and they kind of point it this way, and everyone goes off that direction.
Follow me, yeah.
So once they're in the vicinity, then Charlie, what are the best flowers that these bees are telling each other about?
Well, they're going after the flowers, looking for two things mostly. It's nectar and pollen.
Mm-hmm.
So nectar is the sweet stuff, you know, the sap of it. And that gives them a lot of sugar, a lot of energy. And the pollen is really more of the kind of the long-term, the complete meal, you might say. It's got protein in it. It's got fat in it. That's why pollen, I mean, people who could buy pollen and use it as a dietary supplement, and it's very good for you in that way. And that's really what the bees are looking for. And they're going out on these reconnaissance missions looking for patches of these flowers, whether they be wildflowers, whether they be trees, shrubs, or garden flowers.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be looking for these patches, and like I said, they'll come back, tell their other bee friends, and they'll all go there and work those flowers, bringing back these needed nutrients to the hive.
I think it's funny. I think sometimes people think that only the bee, you know, whether they're hived bees or wild bees, that they really just go look for your annuals or perennials. And we forget about the trees and the shrubs and all these other flowering plants, essentially everything flowers, that can provide them with food throughout the entire season as well.
Yeah, and especially things that we call weeds, like dandelions, for example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the earlier flowering wildflowers that are out there, if you start looking at it in the view of this is a wildflower and mm-hmm. not a weed in my lawn, you watch them in the spring and you'll see the bees working them really hard because they are getting that pollen and that nectar at that time of year when there's little else that's flowering. So they are working those. They're working the trees, trees such as poplars, hawthorns, a lot of the fruit trees, of course. Many orchardists bring in hives to do the pollination, but the native bees will be doing that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Willow trees, blueberries, all those kinds of bushes and trees that you might have around your yard are really essential for the bees, as well as all those other flowers.
So what colors can bees see? What appeals to them most?
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting, because bees, if you want to plant a garden to attract bees and support bees, which everyone should be doing, especially with the concerns about honeybees and the colony collapse that's been going on around the country, it's great to be planting flowers and trees and shrubs that you know that the bees are really going to find beneficial to have. They particularly are attracted to the colors blue, purple, violet, white, and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So they can see those. They can't see red. They really, when they see red, they're really kind of seeing a great thing. So putting some bright red flowers out there are really not going to do much for them. But if you can plant flowers that have more of the blue, purple, violet, those kind of pastel colors, and yellow, they can see those pretty well.
So, Charlie, I wonder if red flowers somehow are just not as nutritious for them.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I don't really know why,
they wouldn't be able to see them.
Like any other creature, that they're eyesight and their hearing is different than humans, so
sure.
I'm not quite sure how it evolved and where bees can't see red and we can and a lot of other animals can.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean you don't plant red flowers. I mean, you shouldn't just have a blue and
sure.
yellow garden.
Right.
That's my bee garden. They will find the flowers, of course, because they use other senses other than the sense of sight to find the flowers. And if there's a nectar and pollen source there, they will use it.
Mm-hmm.
But the key with doing a garden to attract bees is to make sure you have something flowering from early spring right into fall. So from the early columbines all the way down to the asters, make sure you have different things flowering for them at different times of the year so they have a consistent food supply. And also consider having different shaped flowers in there because different bees are going to be looking for different kind of shapes. If you have those umbel kind of flowers, those flat ones like an echinacea, it's really easy for a bigger bee to land on that and to work that one. If you have a bunch of tube flowers like fuchsias or bee balm or even trumpet vine, you have the bigger ones like the trumpet vines, you get bumblebees going in there, and the smaller ones like the fuchsias and the bee balm, the honeybees would like.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of bumblebees and bigger and smaller, have some flowers that are big flowers, that are like a hibiscus flower, that a bumblebee can get into. I was watching one the other day on my deck. I have some calibrachoas, which are these small little petunia-like flowers.
Right.
And I had this big, fat bumblebee trying to stick his face into this little flower. He was working really hard.
That's a good point. Yeah, size matters here.
So have some big flowers out there for the big guys.
And
then have
fast.
Smaller flowers like butterfly weed, Asclepias, or those kind of smaller composite flowers for the smaller bees that are out there so they can work those as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, help me conceptualize the pollen part's they're gonna pick up from the stamen, and then they're gonna suck nectar out of this flower as well. So the petal itself isn't really doing anything, but recently plant breeders, you know, that's what we see and that's what we like. So they've been bred to get larger and double petals and, you know, bigger and flashier sorts of blooms.
Right.
But at the expense of what? So, like, is an old-fashioned variety of a plant more nutrient-rich than a newer variety of a plant?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, because it is true, as breeders have bred flowers to be showier, bigger, flashier, a lot of times what they've lost in there is the amount and the quality of pollen and nectar that those flowers produce, because those are not things that they're breeding for.
Mm-hmm.
But those are what the bees need. So if you really want to have a garden to support native and honeybees and bumblebees, grow a lot of heirlooms, grow a lot of the old-fashioned flowers, because those may not have the big showy flowers on them, but they will have the quality and quantity of pollen and nectar that the bees really like.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other flowering insects that help pollinate the flowers, do they divide the work up here? Will bees do something over here and wasps over here, or do they intermingle?
Yeah, well, there are certain flowers that will attract everybody, and there are certain ones that bees will like more and wasps will like other. I'm thinking of my blueberries are always seem to be worked by the bumblebees. They mm-hmm. seem to really like the blueberry flowers. And I'm sure there is variations even regionally, too, of the kind of native bees you have and what kind of flowers and mm-hmm. trees and shrubs that are there. I'm not that clear on the specifics of which ones go which direction.
Yeah.
And it seems like if there's a good pollen source out there, everybody knows about it.
Right. Well, and you know, and if you think about it, too, many of those good parasitic wasps that we want in our garden to help us control pests, they like the herbs with the umbel-shaped blooms.
Yep.
So it is a whole different sort of, you know, flower setup for sure.
Right, right.
Does the, let's see, the meal that the that the bee gets from the flower, does that take any energy away from the flower?
Not so much, no. Uh-huh. I mean, and actually they're performing a function in a lot of
sure.
ways because they're working flower to flower. So the old-fashioned flowers where there still is a very viable sexual parts, you might say, mm-hmm. in there so that they can reproduce,
mm-hmm.
They're spreading the pollen from flower to flower. So they're pollinating flowers. That's why orchardists want them in their apple trees, for example,
mm-hmm.
because they're spreading this pollen from flower to flower, and they work hundreds if not thousands of flowers. So they're performing a very valuable function by gathering this pollen, gathering this nectar, at the same time inadvertently spreading the pollen around, too, so that flowers, trees, and shrubs are getting pollinated.
Mm-hmm. The difference between wild bees, I guess, and hived bees, you know, if I'm out in my garden mm-hmm. and I live in, you know, somewhat of a rural area, although I do know that some people have hives around me, are the honeybees that I see most likely from somebody's hive, or are there good native wild honeybee on their own colonies?
Well, there are both going on, and I think a lot of the native bees, unfortunately, have died off because of the mite problems and
okay.
diseases and the colony collapse. But I'm sure that there are still hives of those around. Whether you're looking at them, you or I could tell, is this a domesticated bee or a wild bee? I'm not sure we could tell.
Mm-hmm.
Probably someone who's an expert at it might be able to. But I think you need to also expand your vision beyond just the honeybee and the bumblebee, because there's a lot of other kinds of bees that do pollination that are just kind of flittering around. And you go out on a summer day when it's bright out there and you see all these activity and just kind of sit next to an agastache plant or a mint plant that's flowering
mm-hmm.
and just watch all the variety of bees that are working it. And there's lots like the solitary wasps and the mason bees, and there's a number of other kind of native bees that are out there that are doing really important work, but we just don't give them the amount of credit that they're due.
Mm-hmm. Where are they nesting as a wild bee? And that, you know, we don't have a box for them that we bought.
Yeah, there's not a
set
box.
Set them up.
Think of the old nursery stories about the bears going up in the tree and sticking their paw in. Well, that's what they're doing. That's where the beehives are, in old snag trees,
okay.
in old wood piles, old fallen trees, logs, things like that. So if you have a landscape, if you're in a more rural area and you've got some land around you, leave some of those old snag trees up and leave some of those old wood piles in the woods there,
right.
because they could be the habitats where the beehives are,
mm-hmm.
and it could be an important place for them to form their hive.
So not just about flowers.
It's not just about flowers, exactly.
Right.
And it's also good to have in your own landscape a variety of different plantings, not just for the pollen and nectar, but also as a shelter, a place where they could go on a windy, rainy kind of day, or mm-hmm. when it's really hot out. Some evergreens might be nice to have around. Hedgerows, places like that. Places for them to kind of hide
mm-hmm.
when they
wow.
need to.
Well, Charlie, you're definitely not a B-level guest. We'll say that.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
You're very welcome. It's great to be on.
Writer and commentator Charlie Nardozzi has contributed to many national gardening forums and television shows. For more information on Charlie or the bees, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Plan B, everything you ever wanted to know about the hardest working creatures on the planet. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And Bob, just the other day, I was reading Plan B, taking a break from reading, sitting on the veranda of the barn where I like to read. And I went back to pick some lavender. And what did I see?
A bee.
A bee, a honeybee.
All right.
Right on the lavender. And then I was walking across the grass where there's loads of clover everywhere. The chickens love the clover foliage.
Yeah.
And then what do I see?
More bees.
Little honeybees on the clover.
There you go.
And it just really delighted me. And I think it's, you know, reading this book has revealed so much more about the honeybee.
Fascinating creature.
It's a very fascinating creature. Yeah. I don't know. How's your relationship with bees these days?
I've never been stung that it bothered me. And no, we have them out certainly in Hidden Hill. And again, reading this book, I was, we keep using the word fascinated, but you forget how complex their society is. And you wish we could borrow some of their traits for mankind, honestly.
Yeah. But it definitely makes you appreciate them.
Yeah.
You know, more.
The relationships.
Yeah.
The relationships. I always come back to the symbiotic relationships in nature that we lose when you take out one part of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the bees are one vital part of it.
It's a great little book. Great little book. Yeah. Really well written. And we're going to talk to Susan right now. Susan Brackney is the author of Plan B. She's a nature writer. Her pieces have been in the New York Times, Organic Gardening, among others. She's also a gardener and a beekeeper. She lives in Bloomington, Indiana. She's just published her fourth book, which is Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. Susan, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. Okay. This book could have been a love affair talking about chickens, but serendipity wouldn't have it that way, right?
That's true.
You started a love affair with bees instead. Give us a little history about how you got into keeping bees.
Well, in a way, it started with a love affair, you could say.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to have bees, but at the time I thought the equipment's expensive, I can't really afford it. So I just sort of put it on the back burner. And one day a friend of mine called and asked if I still wanted to have bees, and I said yes. And he said, well, you're a beekeeper now. Because he had gone to a yard sale. Apparently a man who kept bees married a woman who was allergic to bees. And he gave up all his stuff in a yard sale, and I got it from my friend, and he said all he wants in return is free honey for life, which seems like a good deal to me.
That is love, to give up your beehives for your mate.
That's what I think. I mean, a more cynical person would put it in storage, wouldn't they?
Right.
I talked to the divorce attorney before
that's
you
right.
proceeded.
So hopefully that couple still is together, and we suspect that it is, they are, huh?
Hopefully, yes.
That is a beautiful story. Okay, so this is how you sort of equip yourself with the things that you need, but surely you need, you know, knowledge to go along with that, not just the tools.
Oh, absolutely.
Many mentors along the way, I suspect?
Some. There aren't as many beekeepers around as there used to be. So you kind of have to seek them out, but fortunately they're always very willing to teach.
Mm-hmm.
I knew a couple who let me sort of shadow them for a little bit, and I also took a short beekeeping course, but honestly a lot of it is just flying by the seat of your pants. Mm-hmm. There is no right way to have bees and manage them. There's so many different ways to do it. You just kind of have to find what works for you and your bees.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it was trial and error, and in the beginning I was doing some things wrong and the bees were trying to tell me, but I wasn't really listening. It took a lot of stings and some time to pass before I figured out that, oh, I'm doing some things wrong here. I need to change what I'm doing, and then I had much better results.
I think this is why I enjoyed the book so much, because it's instructional, certainly, but you take us through these educational things with your own experiences and great writing, and you know, I kind of feel like I'm in it with you as you went through the trials and tribulations of learning how to be a very good beekeeper. So yeah, maybe the best way to learn is through experience. Yeah,
and speaking of which, the bees are the ultimate multitaskers, it would seem, at least in some segments of their lives. So give our listeners a little bit of sense about the drones and the workers and the bees that go out and get the honey and the various levels of sophistication within those hives.
Well, sure. The worker bees, I don't know if your listeners all know this, but all the workers are female.
Mm-hmm.
And they have all kinds of different jobs that they rotate through depending on how old they are. So when they hatch, the first thing they do is clean out the cell that they were just living in so that it can be used again by the next, you know, larval bee. They go on to be nurse bees and help other baby bees get raised. They are general house cleaners, and then there are foraging bees that go out and collect nectar and honey. Mm-hmm. There are even undertaker bees who are in charge of taking out any dead and flying them as far away from the hive as they can, and just making sure everything's really tidy. And there are guard bees who certainly some of us have had the displeasure of meeting, I guess. If you're disturbing their nest and they need to take care of business, those are the ones who will sting you. So there's lots of different jobs for worker bees. The queen, her only job is laying eggs, and she does it robotically. In the height of the season, in a really big hive, she can be laying anywhere from 1,200 to 2,000 eggs a day. Mm-hmm. And that's all she does. Her attendants feed her and groom her and all that, and she just keeps on laying. So that's pretty much her life. And then the drone. Now, there's an interesting story.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the male bee.
Yeah.
And he's really big. He's got these big eyes, and he's really muscular. He doesn't have a stinger. And all he is for is mating with the queen. That's it. I mean, he doesn't do anything else. He kind of bumbles around and eats honey and makes messes, and he's allowed to go in other hives, even that aren't his own bees. He can go anywhere he wants. So he kind of has the run of the place for a while. Mm-hmm. However, if he's being unlucky enough to mate with one of the queens, well, let's just say he doesn't survive that experience. And if he doesn't mate with a queen, but he's unlucky enough to have been born late in the season, and it starts to be fall or even coming on to winter, the bees will actually bar the door, and they won't let any drones back in the hive.
Amazing.
Because they're a liability at that point. They don't do anything. So.
Jeez. And then I didn't realize that the queen's life ends in murder, frankly.
Well, it can, yes. Yeah. It's usually a tragedy of some sort.
Explain that.
For whatever reason, sometimes the bees sense that she is just not up to par, or maybe she'll get injured, or maybe something will happen to her. Even during a manipulation of a hive or an inspection of a hive, a beekeeper can inadvertently, you know, squish her, and there, you know, there you go. So for lots of different reasons, bees will either dispatch her on their own, or if something's happened to her naturally, then they'll realize we need to make a new queen, mm-hmm. and they start that process.
Well, let's sort through some of those details, Susan. And I mean, I guess we really should start with the whole mating, because that's what I think amazed us so much, is how the colony can manipulate the population of the hive. So we do need to start with the whole mating thing. The queen mates, and I would love for you to describe sort of what happens, because it's so fascinating.
Well, I don't know how much gory detail you want me to go into.
I think a reasonable amount is fair, because it's
okay.
So fascinating.
Like, she can carry 5 million sperm.
Yeah.
But she really does.
It's amazing.
And why the male drone dies after mating.
Well, virgin queens, when they're going to go on their maiden flight, they don't mind light at all. In fact, they're kind of attracted to it, and they fly way up high. And drones, they're really muscular and have those big eyes so that they can spot the queen and fly really high up where she is.
Okay.
That's why they look the way they do. They're designed for mating.
Sure.
The fastest drones that catch up and see her are the ones that get to mate with her. And if you were up high with them, you would actually hear an audible popping sound.
Wow.
when they've mounted her, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. and they've deposited their sperm. Their organs actually snap off into the queen, and the bee, without his stuff plummets to the earth, wondering what on earth happened. And how did he get there? And then other drones follow up right behind him and have the same fate. So usually the queen will mate one time, but sometimes, you know, she might go out more than once, but not very many times at all. She'll have all the sperm that she needs from that point on. And once a queen has mated, she no longer likes sunlight. She wants to be in the darkness, which is handy because she's going to be in the darkness in perpetuity, laying egg after egg.
Well, and then they only live 4 to 6 weeks. Does the queen live longer?
The queen can live up to 5 years, sometimes more, but she rarely has that opportunity. For whatever reason, somebody decides, you're not working out for us anymore. And she's replaced.
How do they learn all this stuff?
Well, I don't know if they've learned it so much as it's just kind of in their genes. They've been doing this for thousands of years.
Well, it must have evolved at some point.
You know, although I look at them and I feel like they know me and they're thinking about all this stuff, truly they don't. I mean, they're just doing what they've been programmed to do.
So, okay, they can manipulate. Okay, now that the queen, she's done her mating, she's got her sperm, she uses it whenever she, you know, at will, as she's laying eggs. And at this point, the makeup of the hive is determined by what jobs need to be done, right, and what the population numbers are. So she can, the workers and the nurses, they can make a male or a female bee for a specific job based on what they feed them and how they treat them. Is this true?
Yeah, it's a case of you are what you eat.
Yes.
In this case, everybody starts out the same as a little egg. And larval bees that are fed, say, a coarse mixture of honey and pollen might become drones. Bees that are fed, or larvae that are fed, maybe not such a coarse mixture, finer mixture of honey and pollen, will become workers. And larvae that are fed royal jelly will become queens. But everybody starts out the same, which is fascinating
it
to me.
It is. I think it's fabulous.
Yeah, who does the counting? Who decides how many drones we need, how many worker bees we need, and so forth?
Boy, that's a good question. I haven't figured that out yet.
It's just amazing.
The nurses know somehow.
It really is. And some colonies tend to make more drones than others, and I beats the heck out of me why.
Wow.
So, royal jelly. What makes royal jelly, and what and eating that makes you a queen?
Well, you know, they put it in face creams and all these cosmetics and things, and it's got all these mystical, magical properties. But honestly, it's kind of gross. Very young worker bees produce royal jelly from a gland inside their heads. It's kind of a weird substance, and I don't think that researchers have, you know, done double-blind studies to see if it really does all the things that people think it does. So who really knows? I'm kind of grossed out by the fact that it comes out of somebody's head. So I leave it well enough alone. And besides that, it takes an awful lot for our own applications. And, boy, they don't make very much of it.
Yeah, fit for a queen, huh?
Do you have any
sense
of what percent of the bees actually go out and forage and find pollen and bring back the stuff for the honey?
You know, a lot of that depends on the size of the nectar flow at any one time. It's interesting. The quality of honey that you get, the taste, it varies so wildly depending on the time of year, the weather that year, what flora you're near. So if it's a really good season, you're going to have lots of population growth, and you're going to have lots and lots of foraging bees. If there's not a lot out there for them, for whatever reason, then you're not going to have as many foragers. It's just very changeable.
Well, can they go back from being foragers to taking care of the young if they have to?
It's more of an age thing, but certainly they do pinch hit when needed.
If it needs to be done, it's done. So let's move outside of the hive, and what is a foraging bee day like? You know, how do they navigate as they forage about on a good, you know, we're having a very good season now. I would imagine you are in Bloomington, too.
It's been pretty good.
So what is it? What's the foraging bee doing as he heads out for his day's work, or she heads out for her day's work?
Well, she is going to be looking around and smelling for good sources of nectar and pollen. And bees can actually see differently than we do. They see UV. So flowers look different to them than they do to us. They might have, you know, something that looks kind of plain, like a brown-eyed Susan, mm-hmm. looks really striking to a bee
because
it has all kinds of landing markers on it, kind of like a runway.
Wow.
So they use their eyesight to see, you know, where they want to go, but they also detect floral scent trails in the air. And, you know, they're attracted to flowers that have good sources of pollen and a high nectar flow. Mm-hmm. And flowers release their nectar at different times of the day.
Sure.
So they even know when to go to collect pollen and nectar from flowers. And certainly the scout bees that find some good locations come back and communicate to the other bees by dancing.
Wow.
And they even have nectar that they transfer to the bees, sort of like a free sample.
Oh, to really tempt
yummy.
Them.
You should go check this out. It's you know, a few kilometers over there.
Wow.
It's pretty neat.
So they have a certain dance to sort of tell the bees where to go.
Yeah, they do. They actually kind of recruit other bees to go check out what they just found and come and collect it with us and bring it back. And I've heard that they even store the nectar from different flowers in certain sections of the hive. Like this section is for lavender, and this section over here is, you know, for something else.
Okay. So the question, why make honey? Is it really just to store up food for the wintertime to feed to the other bees when they're babies? I mean, you know, why make honey?
They are really just making that for winter storage, just to get through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That is not their preferred food source. They like nectar.
And pollen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
that's just a way to make sure you've got...
That's right. They need about 60 pounds of it to get through the winter.
Well, how many bees get through the winter? What percent of the hive?
Well, I think of it in terms of the size of a softball or a basketball. I know it sounds strange, but bees cluster in the winter. They don't hibernate. They just form a tight little ball with the queen in the middle, and they create heat and keep her warm. And the size of that ball needs to be pretty big at the start of winter. So a basketball is a really good, you know, size of bees to start with. The bees on the outside edges die off as the, you know, weather, winter progresses. And by early spring, if you have, you know, a clump of bees that's at least the size of a softball, you should be okay. It's not ideal, but... You know, I haven't stopped and counted those bees, so, but not very many.
So maybe 90-95% will die over the winter, you think?
A lot of them do. The bees that are raised towards the end of the summer are bees that are designed to live longer, actually.
To make it through the winter.
That's right. A worker bee during the summer maybe lives 4 to 6 weeks, but in the winter they can live, you know, up to 140 days or so. So
sure.
Quite a long time.
Now, are the drones protected like the queen, or do they have to make more drones in the spring?
They just make more in the spring when they need them.
Well, no fair.
I think that's great. just a couple more questions because we know that you have to go. How can we become more bee-friendly?
Well, there are a couple really easy things to do that really don't require much effort at all.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, you and your neighbors might decide you don't want to do this. I don't know. But my neighbors haven't minded. Raise the deck on your lawnmower about an inch and let the clover and the dandelions do their thing. Especially the dandelions, because they're a wonderful source of pollen for the bees. And pollen is like protein and bread kind of mixed together into one.
Early in the season.
So, you know, let the weeds grow a little bit.
I think I'm bee-friendly, Susan, already.
and try, if you're a big gardener, try to have something blooming almost year-round. Mm-hmm. Really look at the whole calendar and plant bulbs that'll bloom early in the spring. Plant perennials that will go on and on into the late fall. The other thing, probably the most important thing, is if you're using pesticides or herbicides, don't. Mm-hmm. Or use them very sparingly. If you do want to apply something like that, choose a Category 2 or 3 product. The EPA rates those. Mm-hmm. And apply it at night after the bees are done for the day.
Can you talk quickly about colony collapse disorder, the fact we're losing so many of these bees?
Yeah, sure. Researchers are making headway, but I think folks still aren't completely sure what's going on. I think the consensus is starting to be that it's pesticides, stress, poor nutrition, some pathogens, sort of working
of
in concert.
Yeah.
But 90% of some bee colonies are disappearing, right?
Yeah, up to 90%. Some beekeepers have lost that many, yeah.
Wow. All right, well, we will be more bee-friendly. Thank you so much, Susan. We appreciate it, and the book is great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Uh-huh. Susan Brackney is a nature writer, gardener, and beekeeper. Her newest book is Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet, published by the Penguin Group. She spoke to us from her home in Bloomington, Indiana, where her hives are surely busy. For more information on beekeeping, Plan B, and Susan Brackney, please go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Two more questions.
A couple more questions.
One of them is kind of difficult to talk about, but given the colloquial name for the problem, but I'll let you address that one.
All right. You'll give the honor to me.
Yes, ma'am. Sarah M. from Sarah M. Sounds mysterious. Sarah Mysterious. After such muggy weather, we had a few clumps of orange fungus quickly pop up in our hardwood mulch in our garden. I hit it with the hose, which resulted in a huge cloud of black smoke. Is this smoke or fungus at all dangerous to humans and animals? What do you suggest to get rid of such things? Thank you, Sarah M.
Sarah, you're perfectly safe. Yeah. It's a type of slime mold, and slime molds come in all different kinds of colors.
And aptly named.
And aptly named. And often you do find it growing in hardwood mulch.
Mm-hmm.
Affectionately,
right.
People will call it dog vomit or slime mold.
We can say that in the radio.
Because it looks, it does kind of look like a dog might have thrown up there.
Yeah.
And the poof of black smoke, as you say, is really just the spores being released, and that's how it reproduces. It's not harmful. I mean, you don't want to sniff it, but it's not going to hurt anybody or an animal. And probably your best bet is to more gently rake, as soon as you see it, more gently rake it out, and separate it, as opposed to blasting it, which is going to make it poof a little bit more. It's really just the nature of the beast, as you say. When the weather got muggy and hot, these things start to, and if there's adequate rainfall, these things really start to pop up. But I wouldn't worry about it.
No.
You can't kill these sorts of things other than just disturbing them when they pop up, whether it's a mushroom or a slime mold.
Yeah, they like hardwood mulch. That's what they eat. That's what they live on. And as part of that, I remember as a kid, I used to go around and love puff those puff balls and puff them and watch the spores.
It's pretty cool, quite frankly.
Fly around, yeah.
Yeah. So.
And it explains a lot of things about me, perhaps. But
yeah. Maybe it is damaging on second thought.
Right.
All right. Here's a question from Marcia. She has a Navajo pyracantha. Mm-hmm. The berries turned black last year, and she was worried about the same thing happening again this year. She was wondering, what she should do to sort of offset any sort of problem for the pyracantha again this year.
Yeah, she mentioned sulfur spray mixture. There's sprays you can do for that. And I guess you'd use them start right about now. Just follow directions on the label, as they always say. But
it sounds like it was probably scab.
Yeah.
If the berries turned black, it's a fungal disease called scab.
Right.
So spraying it with a fungicide, you know, like sulfur, right when the buds start to form and thereafter should help. But quite frankly, Navajo is a resistant variety.
Yeah.
And if you recall, we had a very wet, cool spring last year. So it's probably not likely that it'll happen if, as long as, you know, we dry out, which we have basically in the last couple of weeks.
You know, what's interesting is this runs directly into a conflict with the earlier part of the show and the bees,
mm-hmm.
where you spray these things to get rid of the scab or fungus,
mm-hmm.
and you're also eliminating some bees and bugs along the way. But what do you do?
But the copper sulfate should be a safe fungicide to use in terms of not killing the bees. There's a little, since you bring it up, there's a little controversy with its use as an organic control, because copper sulfate can kill earthworms. So you would want to use it sparingly just on the foliage, you know, that sort of thing, and not let it drip into the soil.
It goes to the tricky part of bug and weed control in your garden.
Exactly. So sounds like scab. Get your fungicide on as the buds begin to pop.
If you have a tricky question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have?
I'll bet you thought Bob was going to do bee bomb.
I don't give it a thought anymore. I like to be delightedly surprised.
Well, I'm going to delightedly surprise you.
Is it bee bomb?
No, of course not. It's lemon balm.
Lemon balm. Okay, another balm.
Yeah, the Latin on that is Melissa officinalis.
Huh, okay.
And it's kind of cool. It's not related to the bee bomb or Monarda at all.
Balm is a word that designates something else.
Lemon balm is a perennial herb in the mint family. It got its name because Melissa is Greek for honeybee.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that cool?
Okay. There's
officinalis, of course, you know what that is.
Uh-huh.
Do you?
Yeah, it's like doesn't have to do with like herbal?
Yeah, plants sold in apothecary shops, traditionally thought to be medicinal.
Right.
So officinalis is correct.
Yeah.
Anyway, the lemon balm is hardy to zone 4 to 7. Do you grow it?
I do not, no.
It'll recede a lot. It's got these cool, small white flowers later in the summer that the bees love.
Okay.
It's 24% citronella.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Thus the lemon.
Yeah. And it's got a lot of history to it. It goes back to ancient Turkey, where the ceremonial life of the bee was the model. Hmm. The great goddess was the queen bee, and she had the human form, and her priestesses were called the Melissaei.
Huh.
It sounds like the cops or something. If you lived a righteous life, your soul returned to heaven like the bees returned to the hive.
Wow.
And these Melissaei, of course, grew lemon balm just to be sure that they ended up in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And moving along, the Roman Emperor Charlemagne ordered that lemon balm be planted in all monastery gardens, which became, of course, the hospitals for the poor people of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the cool part. About the same time, the lemon balm perfume named Carlamite Water became in high demand to wash the stench of unwashed bodies because they only took a bath once a year.
Hmm.
Later on, the colonists brought lemon balm to America for cooking, flavoring, and herbs and so forth, but it fell out of favor as a medicinal because it was so weak people didn't throw up enough to keep the doctors happy.
Oh, no.
So good
in cooking if you didn't have lemons. You
needed
your lemon balm, and most people wouldn't have lemons.
No, they wouldn't.
Back then, huh?
Comes with a poem. To be or not to be was never the question when lemon balm was mentioned. The useful insects were always around, drawing the world's attention. Going back in history when Turkey was a power, when men were men and women regretted it, and nobody took a shower. A time when people worked in dirt, their sweaty muscles to flex, so called it a bloody miracle that anyone had sex. So let's all give praise to a tiny flower, indeed a standing ovation, for it had not been for the lemon balm, there'd be no world population.
Very nice.
Well, sure.
It just brings attention to the fact that we use so many different plants for different reasons.
Yeah.
And maybe I should grow lemon balm. And instead of squeezing a lemon into my tea, I can just crush up some lemon balm.
And you'd save some water because you only take a bath. Yeah. Once a year.
Well, I'll use the water well for that. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Kentucky and Indiana are actually taking some preemptive measures to stop something that's called the white nose syndrome in bats. We have not had any confirmed cases in either state yet, but some of the caves are closing down. We're going to, see what's going on and why it's somewhat of a threat, serious enough to close the caves.
Homegrown is produced by the benighted Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.